David was under threat once more. Saul was not going to give up. He was jealous of this young man who seemed to be now the favourite amongst the people. They wanted David. And Saul was yesterday's man. And so he sets up another plan to have David killed. He sets spies at the house that David and Michal were now sharing, away from the palace, it would seem. He wanted to send his men in the morning to take David, to bring him to him, and perhaps under some trumped-up charge, have him put to death. Michal hears of this rumour. She perhaps sees the man outside the door. And so she warns David. And she says to him, "We must escape tonight. Tomorrow will be too late." And so she hatches a plan of her own. She lets David out through a window. He runs away. And she puts an idol in the bed, and with some goat's hair she makes a wig and pretends it's David, asleep, ill in bed. And so when Saul's men come in the morning, she says to them, "You can't take David now. He's not well. Leave him here." But that infuriates Saul. He sends them back immediately to say, "Look, bring him to me now. Bring him to me now." And that's what they tried to do. But of course, David wasn't there. So they go back to tell Saul, "Look, he's gone. He's escaped." They also take Michal, it would appear, and she's asked by her father, "Why did you do that?" And she says, "Well, David threatened me. He said, 'Help me out of here, or your father will kill me.'" She's trying to defend the one she loves. She's trying to care for the one she loves, to protect him, to preserve him. Does she know that prophecy that Samuel had made some time before, that David would be the king after her father Saul? Is she doing that? Her motives are unclear. The reasons aren't clear to us. But here she's telling her father, "He's escaped, he's gone. He threatened me that if I didn't let him go, if I didn't protect him, you would kill him." I suppose we need to ask ourselves the question, is she right to tell these lies? Is she right to deceive her father? Is she right to embellish the story? There's no evidence that David was going to kill her. Just simply she wanted David away from Jerusalem, away from the family, away from her jealous father who was seeking to kill him at all costs. I suppose some of us might say, well, that would be wrong. The Bible invites us always to be truthful, not to give false testimony, not to lie to one another. There's the dilemma, I think, here for us this evening, perhaps, and this might be one of the first lessons we have to learn. We have to think about. And at the end, I'm not too certain I know which side I stand on. But there were those times, I think, in the past. If you read Corrie ten Boom's book, The No Hiding Place, and its various revisions after that, you will learn that when she was trying to protect the Jews in Amsterdam in Holland, she lied to the Nazi soldiers. She said, "No, we're not hiding Jews," knowing full well there were Jews behind the cupboard in the wall. And later, when she was in the concentration camps, she lied again, or she was economical with the truth, if we can use that expression a previous Prime Minister coined. Again, to protect those people from further suffering, from further beatings, from further abuse. And if we were to read some of the stories of the Scottish Covenanters in the 17th century, as they were trying to escape the king's men who wanted to put down these troublesome people who were defending that gospel once and for all delivered unto the saints. They too were economical with the truth. There's evidence they would say to the king's men, they went west, knowing full well that they did go west with the intention of going and turning round and going east. I suspect we need to think on that. What would we do in similar circumstances to protect the one that we love? Would we be economical with the truth? Would we, as it were, try to protect them? Or would those principles which come elsewhere in the Old Testament, do not give false witness against your neighbour? Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices. I suspect it is a matter of conscience, a matter of circumstance, a matter for each one of us to make up our own minds and decide for ourselves whether it's right or it's wrong. It would clearly be wrong to lie simply to protect ourselves. But whether it's right to lie for someone else, I don't know. David now, of course, is in exile. He's gone. He's moved away. They're on their own. And what have we got? A Michal who's been abused by her father, used by her father, and perhaps to some extent we'll see in a moment, used by David. Now that David's in exile, Saul marries her off to someone else. He gives her to someone else. She doesn't see David now for some considerable time. I suspect we need to ask ourselves the question, what do we do today in circumstances where people are used and abused? Tony highlighted just at the beginning that meeting for caring for life, for people perhaps who fall into that category. They are on our television screens, we hear their stories frequently, and we distance ourselves from it. Here is someone whose life had been turned upside down by her father's jealousy. She's now lost the one she loved, and she's married to someone she doesn't really love, I suspect. Just part of Paul's plan. But I think we need to examine ourselves to some extent and ask ourselves a question, is it possible for us to use people for our own ends, for our own benefits, to satisfy our own jealousy, our own pride, our own ambitions, our own desire for success? I retired from business life some 20 odd years ago now. And I recognise that business life is different. It's changed. It was changing as I retired. That was one word I could use. The other one was I was made redundant. It depended upon the circumstances, which form I was filling out, as to whether I was retired or redundant. But I sense today it's more difficult for the Christian in the workplace than it was for me then. The pressures are high. Success is what we're judged by. And would it not be easy to abuse those people that might be subordinate to us for our benefit, for our success, for us to reach the target the standard set by someone else for us to achieve? I think it might be. My daughter's taken a career break from teaching simply because there was a change of head teacher. It coincided with the birth of our second grandchild. And she didn't go back after maternity leave. And if we read between the lines, it was because of all those pressures. The head teacher's standards and objectives have been set by others, and she had to achieve them, whatever. So that meant trampling all over those teachers, dismissing some, demoting others, so that she could achieve what had been set for her. I think as a Christian we need to just review that situation. Can we get into that state? Can we be there? Can we do that? Can we be like Saul, whose only interest is his own success, his own prestige, his own position in society, or the workplace, or wherever? I have a great sense of empathy for the Christian in the workplace today, working in conditions that sometimes are difficult, hard, and could be classified as being people used and blessed. We need to think on that. We need to pray for people in places of responsibility, that they might be able to, as it were, maintain the standards that God has set for them. God has set. And it's good that an organisation like Caring for Life is doing its bit. We can't stand by, as so many did here in the story of David, Saul and Michal, and do nothing. The story moves on, and we'll hear the third part.
And it moves on to 2 Samuel, chapter 3, verse 12, page 307, 2 Samuel 3, verse 12. Then Abner sent messengers on his behalf to say to David, "Whose land is it? Make an agreement with me, and I will help you bring all Israel over to you." "Good," said David. "I will make an agreement with you, but I demand one thing of you. Do not come into my presence unless you bring Michal, daughter of Saul, when you come to see me." Then David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, demanding, "Give me my wife, Michal, whom I betrothed to myself for the price of 100 Philistine foreskins." So Ish-bosheth gave orders and had her taken away from her husband, Paltiel, son of Laish. Her husband, however, went with her, weeping behind her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, "Go back home." So he went back.
Saul and his son is dead. And another son has taken over the throne of the northern tribes. He's a weak person. He's really being led by his military commander, Abner. Now, Abner's a much more astute person. He recognizes that David is the great hero. People want him to be king over the whole of the nation. And he decides that his best plan is to actually give him the northern kingdom. Trying to hold on to that would be foolish. And so he sets about making a peace pact with David. That seems to be the sensible thing to do. And so he approaches David and says, look, I will give you the northern kingdom. Now, David recognizes that that would be the benefit for all, including himself. But he also puts in this condition. Before I do that, before I take, as it were, the nations of the north, or the tribes of the north without any force, I want my wife back. Now, David hasn't seen his wife for some considerable time. The chronology, as you perhaps well know in some of these historical books of the Old Testament, is difficult to piece together. It's certainly years. It's certainly years. Why does he want Michal back? Is it for selfish reasons? Is it for political reasons? I want my wife back. Perhaps it's just to demonstrate that he was once married to her, still married to her. She was Saul's daughter after all, and he was the king of the north, and perhaps David could see if I now bring her into my court, I might just be able to convince those northern tribes, those northern people, that I have got a claim over the throne of the whole nation. But he can't wait for Abner to actually act. He can't wait for the wheels of politics to tick over. He acts on his own. He goes and sends his men to bring Michal to him. They start the journey. And her husband, Paltiel, is behind her, weeping all the way. Here is someone that loved her. Someone that's devoted his life to her. And David is ripping that relationship apart. I wonder what was going through Michal's mind as she was making an unwanted journey, perhaps, to David, being taken away, ripped away, in a sense, from her husband. We know the depth of love that Paltiel had for her. It's unclear whether it was reciprocated by Michal, but nonetheless she'd enjoyed some time of peace and tranquility. There'd been stability in her life for the first time, and now it was being ripped up once more, taken out of the familiar circumstances and being given back to David. She was well aware of David's marital status. She may have been his first wife, but now she's well aware that she's going to be a wife amongst many. Paltiel was heartbroken, wept and wept. And then all of a sudden, he's abruptly, rudely, unsympathetically sent home by Abner. Go, leave your wife behind. And go back to your home. What are we to learn from this experience, this circumstance, this situation in this lady's life that reappears from time to time in the story of David and the setting up of the kingdoms of the north and the south? Are there times, perhaps, in our own lives when the tranquility of family life, of life in general, is suddenly and abruptly torn apart by tragedy, by misery, by some degree of sadness? Is that your experience? Has that been your experience? As you look at the lives of other people, perhaps you come into contact with, who've gone through those situations, through those circumstances, how do we react? How did they react? How did Michaela react? That's not clear to us. But of course, for those of us who have a living faith in the great God, on the other side of the coin are the small people, big God. We have hope, haven't we? In those circumstances, in those situations, we have got someone that we can turn to. We can turn to the one that binds up the brokenhearted, as Isaiah puts it, and as Jesus used those same words at the beginning of his own ministry, I've come to bind up the brokenhearted. Or we can reflect on some of the Psalms and know that in God, this big God, we have a refuge, a stronghold, we have strength, and a present help in time of trouble. Is that where we turn? Or as another psalmist puts it, this big God heals the brokenhearted and binds up our wounds. Is that where we turn? We must turn there, mustn't we? Sometimes we turn there eventually, having tried other avenues, but that's where our hope is, that's where our comfort comes from. That's where we must turn in our hour of need, in our hour of difficulty. We rejoice that we know a personal God who is all those things to us. But if we read between the lines, I suspect that that wasn't the experience of Michal. For she perhaps knew of this God. She knew the stories of how God had worked in the history of her people. She knew how David had killed Goliath. She knew too that God had intervened in other situations. But perhaps for her that was just the knowledge. She didn't think that she could turn there. And she becomes, it would seem, an embittered person. A person who has no hope. A person whose life is now just floating in a nebulous situation. Without an anchor, without hope, without foundation. For those of us who know the Lord, we can stand firmly upon a rock. We have somewhere to turn, someone to turn. We turn to our big God, even though we might only be little people. We come to the final part of the story, and we need to hear the last part of the record of Michal's life.
Chapter 6, verse 14. Chapter 6, verse 14. Wearing a linen ephod, David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, while he and all Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. And then we read verse 20. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in full view of the slave girls of his servants, as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people, Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death.
David had tried before to get this Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem, back to the city of David, without success. He failed to follow the rules on the first attempt. But now the armies of the Philistines have been quashed, and it's easier now for him to do this task. And so he sets about bringing the ark back to Jerusalem in the right manner, with the right people carrying the ark. He enters the city. He's now, as it were, bringing the presence of God right into the very city that was to represent, as it were, the presence of God in this nation of Israel. He's doing what he's wanted to do. He's achieved what he hoped he could do. He's full of excitement, jubilation. Here he's bringing the very presence of God, as they understood it then, into the city. What greater thing could he do than that? What greater achievement could he bring about than this? He's so excited that we find him dancing, jumping for joy. "I've achieved what I wanted to do. I've brought, as it were, the presence of this very big God into the city." It was only, of course, a representation of that. But that's how they saw it. God now was entering, as it were, into that presence. And David worships. David offers sacrifices. David is overjoyed with what's happened. He's dancing. Is that our experience when we come into the presence of God? When we sense his presence? Do we leap for joy, jump for joy? I wonder. It's not an easy passage to try and get the cultural connotations of this passage into our 21st century or 20th century or whatever life here. But here is David's enthusiasm for God. The joy that he can bring this big God's presence into Jerusalem symbolically in the ark. He's overjoyed. He's overjoyed. There were those two people. They were with Jesus, but they didn't know it. They made the journey to Emmaus, and there in a communion service, as we might see it today, Jesus revealed himself to them. They knew who he was, this stranger that had accompanied them on their journey was the Lord. He was alive. They were in his presence. What was on their mind? What did they do? There was just one thing they could do. They had to go back to Jerusalem and tell the other disciples that Jesus was alive. And Luke recalls that they went back and their hearts burned within them. They were overjoyed. I suspect they went back a jolly sight quicker than they went. Were they leaping with joy? I don't know. But I think they shared that same enthusiasm that David had. They were overwhelmed, they were overjoyed. Jesus is alive. He is risen. Like many itinerant preachers, Martin Lloyd-Jones had a series, four or five sermons he preached quite regularly. And one of them was on that particular text. And he reminded the people in the congregation, as I perhaps am going to do a little bit later on in a slightly different context, that he would see on a Saturday people coming away from a football match. And the winning side's supporters and fans were overjoyed. They'd won. They were excited. Their team had won. And then he would comment, "I don't seem to see that sort of enthusiasm as you go out of church on a Sunday morning." They were overwhelmed. They were joyful. David mingles with the crowd. We're on difficult ground here. How undressed David was, I'll leave to you. It just says that he was half naked. A difficult word to translate, so the Hebrew scholars tell us. Elsewhere we read that he had an ephod on, a white dress, a white smock type thing. He'd taken off the king's robes. He was mingling with the crowd. He didn't want the glory, as it were, reflected in his direction. He'd brought the ark into the city. He knew that it wasn't as a result of his power, his planning, his achievement. He wasn't the victor. It was God. He wanted all the glory reflected to his God. And so he dresses simply, like a priest, who in turn, of course, when they offered their sacrifices, were dressed simply. No decoration except for the high priest. They were there. All the glory in the sacrificial system had to be reflected towards God. That was David's attitude here. But it wasn't Michal, of course. She was upset. There is her husband, the one that she loved, the one that she devoted the early part of her life to, dancing around half naked, without the trappings of power, without the clothes that goes with the kingly role. He looks just like a servant, just like a slave, just like a commoner. He's not the king. He looks just like a vulgar fellow. She wants to maintain the dignity. She wants to keep up the appearances. The king, as far as she's concerned, has overstepped the mark. It was wrong to be seen undressed, without the fineries of royalty, dressed like a slave or a servant. She was disgusted. She was outraged. I suspect if we were to see the Queen dressed in some sort of simple undergarment, for that's perhaps what the ephod was, carrying out some sort of official duties, we might be able to imagine the headlines. The press would have a field day. Improper, disgusting, not befitting. And there is that sense in which Michal is waiting for David to come home. Wait until you come home. And she makes it abundantly clear to him what she felt, what she saw, what she believed. And David responds, look, I wasn't doing it for the crowd. I wasn't doing it to entertain people. I was doing it for the Lord. He was my audience. I was reflecting the fact that it was Him who had given us the deliverance. He was the big God. He was the one I was worshipping. I wasn't doing it for the slaves or the crowd to impress them. I wanted to impress God. And then, of course, he makes some rather strange and perhaps difficult words. I might even do more in the future. I might even let my hair down even more if I think that's appropriate. I'm not going to stand on ceremony. I'm not going to be constrained by rules and regulations, by what other people think. If I want to worship my God with joy and enthusiasm, if I want to make myself a fool for Christ's sake, I'll do that. I'll do that. There are times when we need to do that, isn't it? We need to recognize the greatness of our salvation and give God all the glory. Give Him all the praise. That might mean that we overstep the mark in the eyes of some, go too far as some are concerned. The commentator wrote this: there are doubtless times to be calm and times to be enthusiastic, but can it be right to give all our coldness to Christ and all our enthusiasm to the world? That's echoing, as it were, Martin Lloyd-Jones's situation. I'll come back to that point in a couple of minutes' time. But we see David, of course, the king, dressed as a priest, or like a priest. Am I stretching the text too far as to say, are we looking this evening at a descendant of David, who, as it were, embodied those same characteristics of a prophet, of a priest, of a king, who wasn't just the priest, he was the sacrifice. He is the one that died for our sins. He is the one that the writer to the Hebrews describes as the priest, Jesus, who offered once and for all the sacrifice for our sins and sat down at the right hand of God. Is that where we're looking this evening? Paul was writing to a church who was bombarded by all the people that were seeing things from the old perspective, but not from the new perspective. Here is a change in the life and the history of the Old Testament people. God is now in their midst, in the Ark of the Covenant, in the city, their capital. Have we disposed of the old things, perhaps, that preoccupied us? And do we see him afresh? Are we still looking at Jesus from a worldly point of view that Michal looked at David? Or are we looking from with new eyes? Are we those new creatures that Paul speaks of, who no longer look at Jesus from a worldly point of view, but see him as the one that came to die, the Son of the great God who died? The text ends with these telling words: Michal bore no children. She was of the old order, the fruitless order of her father. There was now a new order. David, the one chosen by God, anointed by Samuel. And Samuel said, this is the one who shares, as it were, God. Someone after God's own mind. Perhaps this evening, you're still looking from a worldly point of view. Still looking at what this world has to offer. The accolades of this world, the triumphs of this world, the cup of this world. Like the football cup that people hold up when their team has won, and all the joy and celebration of that. But surely our celebration, like this cup of success or whatever it might be, pales into insignificance when we look at the cross, where the great King died for our sins. Michal sadly died fruitless. She was in the old world. We need to be in the new world, made new through a knowledge and living faith in Jesus, the great God's Son.